people come up with great ideas, but they're never consistent, or they can't see it through. Now, sometimes you can't see a project through because there are outside forces that are very difficult to manage, and that's completely understandable. But it doesn't mean to say that you can't, you know, pivot around that or look at a different way of maybe you could, you know, you can make it, you know, something happen. And I think I don't want to use the term either of moaning. That's the wrong term. But I do think musicians have got a great opportunity. We had another conversation with a very good friend of ours. She's probably one of the best music promotion experts in the UK. She works with all the major labels. She's worked with some of the biggest acts on the planet. And she's lovely and she's really to the point. And she's turned around to us and said, it's a great time for musicians to release music. You don't have to have a massive PR campaign. You don't have to, you're not turning to put thousands of dollars behind stuff, because most people can't afford that. And everyone understands that, but doesn't mean to say you can't put stuff into the community. And I would say it's building like a podcast, put something into community, put a record out, put an album out, build it and keep doing it. You know, I don't mean doing one every day, but, you know, keep positively doing that. And I think that's a really good way to go, because the community sees you consistently.
That was just a portion of the great insights contained in my conversation with Peter Moore, who's an industry professional with more than 3 decades of experience in live events, in artist management, pretty much anything involving the music industry. He's been a part of it, and he's going to help us to navigate this new normal of what seems to be a post-COVID world when it comes to the music industry. No matter what you do as a creative professional, you need to listen to this episode, but this is especially addressed to my musician friends, those of you who are looking at live events coming back and you're wondering, just how do you position yourself? What do you do in the meantime while everything is being sorted out in the live event and entertainment industry? Okay. Peter is going to help us with that. So make sure you check in right now, get a notepad to take some notes, and let's jump into this conversation.
Artists, musicians, and creatives of all kinds, looking for help balancing your passion to create with your everyday life? Not sure if your faith can coexist with your profession? Welcome to a place where real artists discuss real life. You're listening to The God and Gig Show. Visit godandgigs.com for show notes, links, and more information.
Hello and welcome to our show. It is an honor to come into your car or your AirPods or your, I don't know, maybe even your shower. I don't know where you listen to this podcast, but thank you for making this podcast a part of your creative day. My name is Alan C. Paul. If you're new to the show, I'm a creative coach, I'm an author and musician, and I believe you're among friends. So I want you to keep listening, because this podcast is going to help you build a better creative life from the inside out by applying some timeless spiritual principles to the temporary creative problems that you might be facing. And we always do so in a practical matter. So we have interviewed people all over the spectrum, from musicians who have played with some of the greats in the music industry of all time, to musicians that are just coming out, independent artists, people who are just now starting, but they also have stories to share and strategies to share. We've interviewed people in every walk of entrepreneurship, from yoga instructors to tax professionals. So we really try to cover everything when it comes to the God and Gig Show that could help you live a better creative life. So I hope you will subscribe to the show. Go ahead and tap it on whatever app you're using, and especially to my Apple Podcast friends. We love reviews. That helps us to get more visibility, and it will bless somebody else who needs to find this podcast as they are searching for information on being an artist, being a creative, and connecting their faith and their art. Okay, so let's move on to today's episode, which is extremely important, extremely timely for a day such as this. And this doesn't matter whenever you're listening to this episode, but I definitely want it to be heard by the people who are listening right about now in 2021. We are at the very, very edges of what we pray is the end of the pandemic. We are hoping that these vaccines that are coming out will be effective, or that people who are social distancing, whatever process you're trying to take to be safe, we are hoping that on a grand scale, that life will eventually get back to normal. And that means for musicians, creatives, people who speak and work in the live events industry, we are hoping that that means we may be back to being in the same room. Wouldn't that be amazing to be able to perform and sing and dance and play and congregate together? But what do you do in the meantime? How do you position yourself? How do you even plan for something when you're really not sure how to move forward in this space of live events, creating music, creating art that's going to be consumed by large groups? In order to find that out, I was so glad to connect with this industry veteran who knows more than I could ever imagine about live events, music festivals, and just the space of business and music that you're going to have to master in order to survive the new normal of a post-COVID entertainment world. His name is Peter Moore, and he is the co-founder of Seamless Entertainment and host of the Entertainment Engine podcast. As I said, he's worked for over 3 decades in every area of the industry: live events, artist management, syncing and licensing, label management. He's done it all, but he has a special expertise in music festivals. So I knew this was the great, great, great opportunity to bring Peter in to talk about his experience with festivals, with live events, and what musicians and creatives should do as they begin to enter this new normal, and how can they keep the most flexibility, the most power, the most ability to make their own way, even when things are not quite sure all over the world when it comes to the pandemic. I also want to mention that Peter did not just jump into the music industry alone without having a very interesting backstory. He also was a professional footballer. And yes, for my American friends, that means what we call it here, soccer. Don't get confused with American football. We're talking about the real football. Most of the world calls it that, okay? And Peter was a high-level athlete. He will tell the whole story about how he was in this world of athletics and sports, and he's going to relate how those lessons he learned also apply to the business of music and entertainment, and how no matter what space you're in, you've got to apply certain principles, certain ways of doing things that will work and will keep you afloat no matter what's going on in our culture or in our environment or in the industry. So that's why I'm so glad to have Peter on. He's going to have some insights. You're going to want to take notes, and you're going to want to pay close attention to how these themes work, both in his business, his life, in the music and arts entertainment industry, and how they can work for you. I hope you're ready for some great insights and a lot of learning coming up right about now. Here's our conversation with Peter Moore. Peter Moore, I'd love to welcome you to the Guiding Gigs program. How are you doing, sir?
I'm very well, and it's lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me. And how have you been? Have you been well?
I actually been well, you know, and thank you for being one of the first podcast guests who's ever asked me that question.
I mean, I just do it every time. I just think it's inbuilt in me that when Rebecca and I, my business partner, we go and do meetings, it's just always built in us to say, how are you doing? How's your day?
Oh, thank you. Well, my day just started. You're in London, I believe.
Yeah.
I'm here in the States in South Florida. So it's 7 a.m. or so. So didn't get the coffee this morning. So if you hear any weariness in my voice, and as we were just talking and getting to know each other, as this is our first time meeting, I am a performer, I'm a musician. So this is for me, I work in the religious space and the church world. So this is around Easter season. So we are in the dead of rehearsal after rehearsal after rehearsal after rehearsal. It doesn't matter what festival. And of course, the pandemic coming back. So people are working again. So my body is still deciding, oh, that's right. You get to move again. You need the energy that used to be just sent right into the home office and the studio office. That's how I'm feeling. But how are you doing? You are the subject of today. So how are you doing? And tell us a little bit as you tell us about yourself. Tell me how you're doing in terms of this transition. I mean, we're recording this in March. And so, tell us how you're doing over there and how are things feeling to you over there in London, even as we get this new post-COVID world seemingly started.
Yeah, it's a really big question, Alan. And I think, to be honest, not much has changed in the day-to-day of what we do work-wise, because we either tend to work from home or we can go into an office into London. And we haven't done any of that. So hasn't really changed.
Okay.
What's been interesting, I suppose, is the fact of the way the world has changed and the way it's opened up new opportunities. So I think what we've tried to do at Seamless, I suppose, is pivot, really. It's probably an interesting word. And try and think out the box of thinking, well, the world sort of turned up on its, you know, upside down for the last 12 months, longer. You know, it's been really sad watching what's happened to people. And I think it's our duty not to sit back and watch. I think it's our duty to actually provide something positive back into the community, because I think, you know, through adversity comes positivity. And I actually do believe in that. So I think, as much as it's been, you know, horrendous in the world, not much on that side of change from us from day to day what we do, but we have decided to actually provide a lot more back into the community, because, again, we felt it was important to do. But at the moment, to give you an idea, in the UK is rolling out the jab. I had my jab Saturday. Rebecca gets hers on Friday. So we have vaccinated millions of people in the UK. Europe's a different matter. I think there's a big issue in Europe at the moment, the whole of Europe. that's just going to be rumbling on. I don't think they've issued the vaccine to too many people at the moment. So we're just seeing what's going to happen there. And again, just lucky to get the vaccine. We know it's not a cure, but we just got to try and do our best and you know, stay out of trouble and try and stay safe, really.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny that even as you started to say that, I started to think again. You mentioned that, I think, the similarities in terms of reaching into the community, having to continue to push through adversity. And what hit me again, those little ADD like connections in my head hit me. It's like, this is basically what entertainment feels like. And with your experience, again, I want you to tell people who you are and what you do and the whole thing, why you have the experience you have to be able to push through adversity, to be able to rethink, pivot, right? So all the different positions that you've held throughout your entertainment career, I do feel like it's been often like that, just like you mentioned now, where, well, there's some situations that you can change, you can prepare yourself, take the vaccines, things like that. And there's some things you have no control over. And you're like, well, we're just going to have to wait and see and wing it. So pivoting to your career, can you just give us, again, a little bit of your background in terms of and how you got into the industry? And I'm very interested, as I'm reading your bio, I'm kind of skipping ahead a little, but to give you a little bit of story, I'm really interested in how you made those major pivots in your life. So I know I'm forcing you to do This Is Your Life in a truncated way. But just tell me about how, number one, how you got into this industry, and what was the major thing that you said, wait, I'm going to have to make a huge change here. And maybe you didn't see it coming, but here you were.
I think entertainment was always with me, but it was quite far away. So I sort of go back to when I was sort of 9, 10 years old, really. And that's effectively when I started playing football. I was always kicking the ball around. And like everybody, you know, every boy wants to probably be a professional footballer or professional athlete or, you know, professional musician. And it was just, I wanted to play football. So I started kicking a ball around, was sort of pretty quick. My dad came and watched me play a couple of times, come back to my mum and said, actually, Pete's actually pretty good. So I got to 11, 12 years old. I then got sort of taken on by different clubs. And then the pivot moment there for me, Alan, was I played for sort of a national team in the UK. It was called the Boys Clubs Association. And so it was basically giving youngsters an opportunity to learn a sport, go further in that particular area. And it was a great experience. And from there, I played in France. I went over to France, played in France. We played a couple of games. And at the end of those couple of games, I had an elderly gentleman come up to me with his flat cap on and his big cigar and in his French accent and, you know, said, oh, I played really well, and just had a brief conversation with him. And came into the changing room, the manager for the French team come up to me and said, oh, did Pereira have a have a chat with you? I said, yeah, he's a nice gentleman, and didn't think much of it really. And he said, well, he's one of the chief scouts for Paris Saint-Germain, which is obviously one of the biggest clubs in the world, playing the French league. I then got sort of asked if I'd want to come over to France to play football. My mum and dad obviously wanted to check out everything to make sure everything was okay. I ended up staying in sort of just outside Paris for about two years playing football. I got selected out of 500 people. There was four places in the academy. I got one of them, was lucky enough to get selected, and that was based on my pure speed and agility. No one could really get near me. At that time, I don't think I've lost too much speed now, really, but nice. At that time I was the quickest in the league. There was only one defender that could get
remind
near me.
How old were you at this time?
13.
Oh gosh. Okay. So that's why I need 13. To reframe it in my head, because just you're talking about these amazing experiences and being invited by one of the top teams. Again, we're I have a lot of American listeners, so I have to remind them he's saying football as in Europe, the real football. We actually use your feet. But yes, just continue. I just wanted to get context and remind myself you're talking about these amazing experiences, and you're 13 years old at the top, of this sport. And okay, so continue. Yes, that, so you got this college, you got this opportunity, and at 13 years old.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I played local football. I also played. We're going to sign professional terms in the UK as well, but because I was out in France. Then I had a slight injury, so I got kept on at school, primary school, for an extra year. And the reason that happened was because I was playing a lot of football, and the headmistress at the time said to my mum, actually, if we keep Pete back a year, he's missed quite a lot of education, and because of football, he's had a few injuries. I like to keep him on another year. So I had to get permission to do that, and actually worked out quite well. So when I went up to sort of the bigger school, I was sort of a year ahead of everybody, but I felt it was the right time to do that. So that was quite good from an education perspective. So I was in France. I got selected. I'd started having a few injuries. I came back to the UK, and I was playing for different clubs in the UK as well before I went back to Paris. And my ankle just kept breaking down, and effectively it was just one of those things where, cause I was so quick, they couldn't believe how fast I was at that age, 14, 15, 16. There was just one player in the country. And even in, when we was playing in France, there's two players there that could keep up with me. But it was as soon as the ball was gone past the defender, that was it. I was 30, 40 yards in front of the defender, and they couldn't catch me. So I kept moving, and my ankle kept breaking down. But taking that a little bit further, I didn't sign professional terms because of the doctor said he's 90% fit. If we sign him off, you know, he could break down. He could have 40 games. He's fine. He could have two games and he breaks down. And it was really at that point that it didn't quite happen. Came back. I this was pretty annoyed, to say the least, for a couple of years. My dad said about me playing local football, which I wasn't, so like local community football, which I wasn't too keen on, but I did. I played in a very good local team that had, funny enough, they had ex-professionals and semi-professional players. So I did that for about 3 or 4 years. but it wasn't really where I, you know, I felt I should have been. But that was by the by. I then said to my dad I wanted to work on the farm, because my dad was, he worked on a farm. He managed a farm for a long, long time. And he said, no, farming's not for you. There's no money in farming. Even though, you know, I grew up with fresh produce. I grew up with apples, pears, strawberries, grapes. You know, the summertime on the farm, picking apples and running around was fantastic. But my dad as a career, no. So then I always had a love for music. Not a musician, not a performer, but I thought maybe I could get involved in something, but I didn't know what. So my dad said to me, look, I think he felt a little bit sorry or a bit aggrieved that I shouldn't be playing football. So he said, look, if you want to get into entertainment and you want to find a job, I'll support your travel as much as I can. And we sort of came to a deal. So I spent 2 years traveling to London, 3 days a week, about an hour and a half on a train, which is, you know, no big thing, but it can be expensive. So my mum and dad supported me to do that. And I would sort of, I suppose to pay my dad back, I would go and work on the farm at the weekends just to, you know, help him out. So it's sort of like a, you know, a reciprocal arrangement.
Absolutely.
Funny thing with money, if my mum lent me money, I never paid my mum back, ever. If my dad lent me money, I always paid my dad back.
That sounds like, but I don't know, just knowing, without knowing your family dynamic, that feels right. That feels like mom's like, you know, I'm going to overlook this. I'm going to give you a little push, you know, don't worry about it. And dad's like, no, we're going to make sure that you knew what it takes to survive in any business. Again, is why I'm so interested in the pivot, because now as you're exploring entertainment, I'm still thinking in terms of lessons you might have learned from the discipline of sports to the discipline of having to handle this in arrangement. So I want you to continue, but yeah, that's kind of like to put a bug in your ear where I start to wonder, did these lessons and this thing that from sports that you almost saw take you to the top of profession, were these lessons following you into your next season, and how did you apply them? So I just wanted to like mention that as you're continuing to tell the story. It's, you know, because I know once you got to London, things must have been totally different. I mean, going into this whole new world. So what were you doing there? What were you doing on those weekends? Like, how are you ingratiating yourself in this whole new world?
Well, it was really, and it's an interesting point you pick up as well, Alan, because sport teaches you an awful lot. And what sport teaches you is the difference between entertainment and sport. There's one very, I think, clear defining moment. When you go into sport and you've got 11 people on a field, you've actually got 11 people on the field that are there to do a job and actually to work for each other and to get a result. And to get a result, I wouldn't say at all costs, but you want to be able to get a result. You don't want to lose, and you want to basically put on your best performance so that when you come off, the manager and team are all happy with what you've achieved. But you're a unit. You go in together as a unit. Entertainment isn't like that. So I'll give you the way that I came into entertainment. I then traveled into London. For 2 years, I didn't get a job. And it was the last, one of the last companies I went into. I'd spoken to them before and there was never any opportunities. So I went in, raining evening, put my CV in, wasn't very happy, basically threw my CV at the receptionist. I was really not very happy, to be honest. And I was tipping down with rain outside. And all I wanted to do was either get on a train or go and grab a cup of coffee because I was just fed up. And at that point, one of the ladies in reception was head of international PR for the whole label. So she looked after 6 labels for the PR worldwide. I was like, okay. Fast tracked that. I ended up sort of working for the label, which was a really interesting experience. So I brought the mechanics of me playing football into a team environment. And it sort of worked and it sort of didn't work because people were very closed off from the industry. Then I started learning people do not want to share information with you and they don't want to tell you how this business works. And that was very early on. Only at the very senior level, people would give you information and explain. And one of the stories that I always remember, and I've said this for many, many times, is I went into a room that had thousands of CDs and I thought, well, that's interesting. What's happening with these CDs? And one of the A&R people that I got to know quite well said, well, actually, why don't you go and pick out a few albums, see what you think, and come and present them back to me, and I'll see if I can present them tonight, the A&R directors, and maybe, you know, go further. So we did. I went through, selected out 4 albums. There was a couple of rock acts and 2 metal bands I thought were very good, you know, very good acts, very polished performers. Thought they were really cool. Presented them forward. Then became the committee that decided whether or not these acts were any good. None of them got taken on. So the moral of that story was there must have been, I don't know the actual figure of CDs, but there might have been a couple of thousand CDs in that room.
Wow.
I took those 4 CDs that I presented. They said, you can keep them. If you want to go and select any other CDs, go down to the room and pick some out. So I probably picked out another, I don't know, 3 or 4 albums that I had, and the rest were just, don't know, maybe thrown out, or I'm not really sure. I got made redundant from that label, and then that taught me an awful lot. But what I learned there was how to put a CD into store, started looking at the mechanics of how a record company works, people that don't really share information. And when they do share information, they're not really giving you enough because they're not letting you into their world, because I personally felt, and I still feel, that they're frightened of losing their job. So they don't want to share information. So I thought, okay, got made redundant. But then the senior people that I got quite friendly with said to me, you need to create something for yourself in the record industry, because this is back in 93, 94. It's going to change. So you need to create something for yourself. I didn't quite understand that at the beginning. Then a friend of mine had a record company, had a small dance label that was sort of owned by Sony. I ended up working for them for a bit, and probably about a year and a half. And they were a small independent dance label that sold, they punched above their weight. They sold quite a lot of records. And one of the jobs that I had was actually going around to all of the record shops and, you know, looking at the point of sale, looking at how many records we sold. And also it was my job to go into the store to buy all the records to get a chart position that week. And then once I bought the records from all of them stores, we'd sell those records at another event. So effectively I'd go into the store to buy the records to get us a chart position to push us up the charts.
So you were basically buying your own...
buying your own music.
Oh, God.
Yeah, yeah, and so things like that I started to learn, and how you get a record into store, and you know all the PR side of it and the press side of it. So that was interesting. Got made redundant from there because they decided to sell the label. They had enough of the industry, and talking to the owners of the label, they had they sort of had enough of the business as well. So I had about 4 years in the industry. At different levels, from the ground up, and sort of had some knowledge. So I learned how to put a CD into the store. I learned how the manufacturing process. I learned a bit about press. Still didn't really understand the business, but I thought, well, okay, what am I going to do? So another sort of interesting pivot moment was a friend of mine was head of student union for a university not too far away from me. So he was looking after the events for this university, and they had 30,000 students probably, from all over the world. So all over Europe, the States, Canada, people used to come to, you know, for their education and learn different subjects across English, maths, history, you know, a whole gambit really, international politics, everything. So he said to me, he called me in for a sort of a coffee, and I said, yeah, I'll come down and have a chat with you. And I said, well, you know, how can I help? He said, well, you've worked in the record industry. You can help me. I went, yeah, but what do you mean help you?
Yeah, that's a very loaded
question. Well, I've got a big question.
Help you with?
Yeah. Well, let's. So we went to the really nice university sort of bar and had a nice coffee, and he said, do you want any lunch? And I thought, hang on a minute, you know, this is great, don't get me wrong, it was a nice lunch and a nice great cup of coffee. And then he said to me, I'm tasked with actually putting on university summer ball and Christmas ball, and I need someone that can come in and help me run the event. And I said, yeah, but I've put a record into store and I've not put on events. It'd be fine, don't worry about it. And that was my first taste of actually live sector. So for about several years, I, with my buddy and a couple of other friends that we got involved, put on, I suppose, over 10 to 12 summer balls and 10 to 15 Christmas balls for universities in the area. We worked for about 6 or 7 universities. Give you an idea, we did the summer ball for one of the universities was 5,000 students. And we would provide all the entertainment, the DJs, the live bands. We provide a casino, obviously where they couldn't gamble, but they would win like sweets, or they would win sort of the latest iPod, or they'd win a 6-month pass to the cinema, you know, stuff like that. So that was quite cool. We had magicians. We had, we hired out stately homes. We did everything. The interesting point there, Alan, was that the budget's already in place. So you didn't have to go and find any money.
Nice.
But you still had to manage the event. So on behalf of the universities. So I did that for quite a few years. I learned pretty much, you know, from the ground up, really, how you promote an event. And it was relatively a lot easier than it would be doing a normal event, because you've got a campus dedicated with, you know, 30,000 students. So it's quite easy to actually go and talk to the students. And,
almost a captive audience. Almost.
Yeah,
right?
That was, yeah. I mean, we would start selling the summer ball mid-February, and we would sell out by the end of March.
Mm.
And they would normally be, to give you an idea, £45 tickets, so maybe $65, roughly, maybe $70 would be. And we'd sell out. We'd sell out by end of March, probably going into April. So that was actually quite good. So then if I jump you forward, then after that period of time, the two lads I was working with on some of the summer balls, we decided to do our own events. So there was two venues in the city where I sort of grew up, just outside of London. And we decided to do our own events. So as a friend of ours owned a wine bar. He was very, very wealthy, didn't need the money. He just had the wine bar because it was something for him to do, really.
Pet project kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. He owned a lot of property. And I, just over a glass of wine one day, I came in. And again, he pulled me over and said, really sort of lovely guy. And he said to me, oh, how's your events going? He said, I see they're doing quite well at the university. I said, yeah, fine. He said, would you be interested in doing something for me? I went, well okay, but what do you want? Well, he said, no, downstairs never gets used. And he's two sort of floor wine bar. And downstairs was a cellar where they used to keep all the wine. And that obviously got all cleared out. So effectively, it was like a TARDIS. So when you go down these windy stairs and you look to the end, you could fit 500 people in this downstairs. And it had already fixed bar as well.
Okay.
He said, we won't license it for 500, but we'll license it for, say, 400. So we're keeping well under the license, you know, regulations. Do you fancy doing something? I said, okay. He said, look, I'll do a deal with you. I'll take all the food and drink, and you take all the ticket money. And if you sell anything on the night t-shirt, you take all the merchandise as well. He said, I won't charge you for the venue. I was like, okay. And we did that for about 3 years. And the thing, going back to football, one of the things that I've taken with me now, even Rebecca would endorse this now, because I still continue my training every morning now as if I was playing professional football. And what that teaches you, or just teaches me, is consistency.
Wow. Yeah.
A lot of people I've come across, Alan, in this, I'm not saying this business, but I'd say in the world, are not consistent. And when you play professional football, if you're not consistent, if I give you something to do, but in the weeks over the Easter and, you know, throughout, you know, say the next couple of months, do a bit of research on, say, the British football scene, and say the European football scene, and you'll see some of the players that are not consistent, and you'll see some of them players that they leave the club because the club doesn't want them anymore, because they're not doing what they're doing. It's probably the same in American football, and obviously the same in American baseball as well. If you're not performing,
Every sport. And it's funny that we're making this analogy to sport, because it's actually, I am thinking of one other interview we did earlier with Daniel Weatherspoon, who's a producer. Mm. Again, like you said, those circles. And I'm thinking about him, because thinking about London and the connection, he actually performed for on Beyonce's live DVD in Wembley.
Yeah,
and he was the musical director for that. And that's one of the things he mentioned. Number one, he actually also, like you, had an injury. Was planning to play a sport, thought he'd be a professional American football player, and ended up injured. Yep. And it's like the world shifted toward this music world. Had that not happened, I almost wanted to ask you that question. And I'm so glad. I'm not glad you had the injury, but it's amazing.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, it's amazing when you look back. It's like, what if, right? What if you, but what if you had not been able to, again, pivot and find your way into this world? I wanted to ask you, since you're talking now about the live industry and getting into it and venues and a lot of lessons you learned back when you were those 4 years just trying to get into the positions, right? And the A&R, and seeing the underbelly of this industry, which can sometimes be, it can turn you off. And again, as a musician who has been on the other side often and feeling like, and I don't want to rope you in with the evil empires, but the labels and the A&R agents and the booking agents and the promoters, where we sometimes have an adversarial relationship simply because we assume they're out to get us, or they don't understand what it's like to be able to walk into one of those venues that you just created. You use it all the work. You do all the work to put together. You mentioned the university, the 5,000 or the 10,000 or the 15,000 people. And I heard in another interview where you talked about all those pieces that had to be put in place. Again, like the football team, like the coach, all these moving parts, and you're responsible. And if something goes wrong, they're not saying, well, you know, the musician really wasn't that great, or, you know, the bar didn't pay attention. They're looking, you know, the boss is looking right at you, or the person that brought you in, like, you know, they're not happy. It's all you. All of it falls on you. Did you ever have any problem with the pressure? You mentioned being brought onto these things. The pressure of being the person that has to manage these things, yet as a, again, musician, performer, I could come in and not be ready, and you have to bear the responsibility for the entire event. Has that ever been a problem, or something that's, you know, been something as far as the pressure of dealing with that type of part of so many things in the industry on that side? We'll get back to Peter's response to that question in just one moment. But before we go forward, I wanted to make sure that you're doing everything you can to reach your audiences effectively, so you can spread the word about what you're doing and have maximum impact. And the best way to do that is through email marketing. No matter what's going on in social media, what you want is to have control over your list and your customer connections, and to have access to your customers whenever you need. And email is still the best way to do that. And we've been doing that for years using a tool called ConvertKit. Now, what I love about ConvertKit is that they are really understanding of the creative experience. As a matter of fact, they are really focused on creatives like you and me in every area, whether it be musicians or filmmakers or writers or bloggers. They understand the creative lifestyle, and their tools are built to help creatives like you and me to reach our audiences effectively. And they're rolling out new features every day. I especially love their new landing pages. I am moving all of my new pages where people can sign up for things like teaching resources and buying products. It's all there in ConvertKit, a one-stop shop for creators like you and me to get control over their email or marketing, their messaging, and to be able to make a living doing what you love. So if you want to learn more about building your list, as a matter of fact, they have a special training that will help you build your list to the first 1,000 subscribers. And you can do so using their tools and learning from their training resources. So go to GoddenGigs.com/build-my-list. GoddenGigs.com/build-my-list. Check my link inside this show's description. Go there and you will find a free class, a free webinar on how to get your first 1,000 subscribers using ConvertKit and the strategies they're teaching you. I can't recommend this enough. For every creative, you got to have control over your message and how you get it out. And using ConvertKit is one of the best ways to do that. Okay, I hope you're going to really take advantage of this resource. Now, let's get back to this engaging talk with Peter Moore. Did you ever have any problem with the pressure? You mentioned being brought onto these things. The pressure of being the person that has to manage these things, yet as a, again, musician, performer, I could come in and not be ready, and you have to bear the responsibility for the entire event. Has that ever been a problem, or something that's, you know, been something as far as the pressure of dealing with that type of part of so many things in the industry on that side?
Yeah, and I use the analogy again with sport as well, because I think what maybe gave me quite a thick skin as well, Alan, was the fact of one of my first encounters actually playing professional football was the manager that I was actually working for. We didn't really get on. So I was, this was one of my first games. I was on the substitute bench, and he just took, my dad was with me at this game, and the manager just turned around to me and said, "You're going on second half. If you don't perform, that's it. You're going home." And it was basically, it was do or die, really. So my dad looked at me. My dad was a big chap, you know, very well, but he was sort of very, um, very quietly spoken. You know, those people that walk into a room is quite, you know, very well built, very tall, but was non-aggressive, was just sort of very calming. And he just turned around to me and said, well, just do what you do. So at that moment, I went on. We were losing 1-0. I went on, scored 2 goals, and we won 3-1. And no one got near me on that pitch. I was absolutely lightning on that day. Manager pats me on the back and pulled me to one side. And I sort of do believe what he said to me, because he turned around to me and said, look, I knew you had it in you. I just needed to give you a big kick up the backside because I knew you could perform. So I took all of that, and I had that several times where managers would come into changing rooms and they'd literally just blitz the changing room. They'd throw tea and coffee everywhere. They'd get really angry because you're not performing. So you have to deal with that. So you just have to deal with it. And if you get substituted, that's it. If you have to train at 6 o'clock in the morning, it's tipping down the rain, that's what you have to do. So I took a lot of that with me into the music industry. And what I found, coming back to your point with the live side of it, is again, no one taught me how to put on a live event. So what do you do? So over time, you go and ask another promoter. They don't want to share any information with you because they don't want you stealing their event or nicking their audience. Or so it all becomes a bit close community. So I thought the team that we had, it comes back down to consistency. So I said, for us to win, be consistent, deal with the musician. We never had any problems with any musicians. Wow. None of them. No musicians, no bands, nothing. Some of our problem was with outside factors, and it would be people that didn't like what you were doing because they wanted to do a similar thing. So we just kept consistent. So what we would do our event on a Wednesday and we'd run it again the following Wednesday. So we would keep the musicians up to the speed of what we were doing. We would tell them what we could pay. If we couldn't pay them, we would tell them. Or if there's a different mechanism we would do, we would explain that. And we keep everyone abreast of what we would do. And I think that partly got me through, because what it leads you on to is that I ended up dealing with the venue, ended up dealing with the promotional aspect, ended up dealing with the artist. Even though I had two partners working with me, they would end up doing more of the promotion and more of the PR, more of the press. And they liked doing that. Even though I do a lot of that now, they enjoy doing that. But I felt, I took it all the way through as if I was dealing as a unit playing football. So I saw each person as a part of the team. The press person was a team. If you're the artist, say, for example, we book you to play, you're on my team. So if you're not happy, you know, we would do as much as we possibly can for you to make sure you got a great experience. So little things like, where do you need to park your car? Well, you can park right at the back of the venue. Do I have to pay for parking? No, because we sorted it all out.
Oh, okay. Is it secure? Can I stop you? You are an angel right now. What you're saying, I'm being very blunt and open right now. These are the kind of things, again, I've been a local, just to let you know, Peter, again, the reason why I'm so interested in this, and I'm believing many of my listeners are interested, because many of us don't get those perks or even that attitude. And I'm not saying to any other promoters that, you know, I have the people that work in my circle, thank God they're just like you. They ask the questions. They see me as an artist, as part of their team. But again, you said you didn't learn this from somebody telling you. You just innately said, hey, the best way to run an event, a successful event and a successful team, is to actually care and look for those details of how I can make this person, including the artist, including the venue, including all the people that are eventually going to come, and make them a part of it. I love what you're saying. I just wanted to jump in because I've had so many moments where it's like, do they see me? Do they understand that these little things, which parking seems to be little until you get to the venue and you're late because you had to drive around the building 4 times. And you're there looking at you like, what happened? And I'm looking at them like, it would have been nice had you mentioned this.
Well, I think I think that's one of the things that, especially with working with Rebecca as well, because she toured all over the world. And when she came in to do her album, and she's methodical in her preparation. So when she was going to do her rehearsals, this is one thing I would say to her. She was going to do her rehearsals. She would pay for the rehearsal room. She would pay because she has to get a boat over from, because she lives on an island. So she lives on an island. She has to get a boat over to the mainland in the UK to go to the venue. So she would do all of that. And then she'd have her musicians turn up moaning that they couldn't park, or it cost them £1.50 to park their car. And I'm like, she just paid £55 to get over, pay for your rehearsal room, pay for your time to go and play, and you're moaning about your parking. So this is the bit, that fraction that annoys me, because I think people assume and they just turn up and they start moaning about all the little things under the sun.
Yeah.
When they don't take responsibility for their own actions. And I think that's can be quite prevalent in the entertainment business, because I think everybody sees entertainment as very fluid and I'm just going to turn up and do my thing. Well, no, it's a business.
Yeah.
And I got taught that very, very, very early on. It's a business. And that's effectively what it is. So that's why we would do the little things, and not being because we're trying to be making you feel like a fluffy ball, Alan, nothing like that.
Well, oh, no.
The reason we do it is so that when you walk away, you've had a great experience, but you also go and talk to other people and say, do you know what? Those guys over there are actually doing something quite cool. All right, they're making money, but I've made some money and I've just played in front of 500 people and I'm quite happy. And that's the way we would build it. We would build it. So I took that all the way through, really, until we got involved in doing bigger events, really. And I just took all that ethos with me. And then that's a different mechanism. That's a whole different ball game. Oh, yeah,
a whole different ball game. I would love for you to talk about some of those big events. But I want to make sure before we get too deep into anything and turn the workings behind it, I do want to turn it around to today and our future. Because unfortunately, as we all know, March of 2021, we're still on the back, what we believe in praying is the backside of one of the most, catastrophic events in terms of the world, but especially in your industry. So you mentioned it earlier when you first started on how you guys are adjusting in London and Europe to the coming changes and how people are going to react. So I don't want you to tell the future. I mentioned this before we got on. I don't want you to try to, get a crystal ball out. But I would ask you in terms of try to keep it specific things so that I don't make it too general. One is, what are you seeing in terms of the future of the live event, in terms of whether things will grow now? You know what I mean? Whether there's opportunity ahead of us in terms of, post 2020 in live events. And then number two, where are there opportunities for the local musicians, the people who don't maybe have they say, I don't have a promoter, I don't have a venue, I don't have a, and they feel like all these things have been ripped out from under them because of COVID. Where do you think that person goes learning the lessons you learned about things that have to be done? Like you said, taking care of your business, treating it like a business. So first, what do you see things for you and your company in the future? And then where do you think lessons could be applied to people like us who are just now getting started and realizing, hey, live events are coming back. Maybe we need to do 1, 2, 3 to get ready.
I think to sort of really narrow that down, I think the first thing I would say, I think live will come back stronger. Okay. I think live will come back even stronger. I think we're in this bubble at the moment. I use the word bubble for what's happened in the world. There's lots of shows in the UK that want to take place. There's lots of big festivals that want to take place. But I've had an issue with this. And my only issue with it is, you can get the insurance, you can get the public liability, and you can get the indemnity insurance for bad weather and, and the non-appearance. But are you going to get the COVID cover? So we're seeing big promoters in the UK pushing their events from May, June, right the way through to September now, because they're trying to get into the point where the UK potentially could open up from June the 21st. Now, that's great. I'm not here saying anything else. Right. I am a big fan of live, and I want to see musicians out there performing, and I want to see live music because everybody loves live music. What I don't want to see is big festivals or medium festivals putting 10, 15,000 people in the field, and then suddenly we go back into lockdown and we just cause a huge problem, because it's the social distancing is going to be very difficult and challenging to be able to, to make that happen. But I do think live will come back. I'm going to say 2022. I think live will come back even stronger. I think musicians, just touching on musicians, I think musicians have had an opportunity in lockdown to even hone their craft even more. So I wouldn't say to a musician, talking to you, Alan, or talking to Rebecca, or talking to any musicians that I've worked with and know, I've said to them throughout this pandemic, this is an opportunity for you to actually do the reset button. Have you got a garage? Yeah. Tell your dad to take his car out of the garage or whatever it is. Get in there and do some rehearsals. Get in there and you can't get your band together, but you can certainly, you know, if you're a bassist or a drummer or a keyboardist or guitar, go and hone your craft. So when you are able to get back into a room and actually rehearse with the band, you're going to be a lot more sharp and a lot more ready to go than you probably would have been a year ago. So don't sit and moan about what you haven't got. Look at what you have got and actually make that better. And I think to maybe answer your point, I can see this point very clearly about how does a musician, you know, you asked me about promoters pulled the rug under their feet. Yeah, what do they do?
Just sorry. There's a lot of PST.
Yeah.
PTSD.
I think it's a good point as well, to be honest with you. And I think what can the bands do? Well, I'd say get together. Okay. Bands know bands, artists know artists. So what I would say is, why can't they all get together? Why can't the four or five bands get together? Why can't they? For one thing, they've got all the kit. Don't need to buy kit. Two, they got the musicianship, so you don't need to go and find that. Three, if you've got four or five bands together, and I'm talking about anywhere in the world, whether it's South America, whether it's the US, whether it's Europe, whether it's the UK, go into a venue as a collective group of musicians and put on a night. Don't wait for a promoter to do it, because one, you're then controlling your own destiny. Uh-huh. Even if it's only a little night with 150 people in a room, 20 people in a room, 100 people in a room, put it on for free. Whatever you want to do, just get people in the door and then do a deal with that particular bar, whether it's drinks or whether it's food or whether it's whatever it might be, you know, selling your merchandising. I think that's the power in to be able to do that. And I think when we're fully out of lockdown and we're able to do that, I think that's something that bands can pivot and actually do well. So the two things that they could do really well is rehearse and rehearse. And then two, build their little community together like a little acorn that builds and builds, and then get four or five bands together and put on their own regular night. Don't travel 100 miles to do something. Do it in your own community and build that little acorn. And I think that's a way that you can create a sustainable local community and bringing back live music. And I think that's clear as day for me. Don't try and get onto the big festivals. Well, no, that's wrong with me. Do try and get on the big festivals, but don't be surprised you're going to be turned away, because that just becomes more and more difficult as time goes on. But create something for yourself. Or if you've got a festival in your own area and you know the promoters, why not approach them and say, well, can we put on our own marquee? Can we do our own thing? Leave us to do our own thing. Do a deal with a promoter, whether it's you have to pay a little bit of money in front, or whether you do a ticket split with them, or you sell your merchandise and you give, you know, revenue share back to the promoter, whatever. There's things that you can do. But I think the best thing is community, get four or five bands together, some artists together, and build your own night. And I think, and you just all share the spoils in that. Why not?
I love it. And that's, again, I think what's so important about this, your statement in terms of I appreciate the fact you stopped yourself. Yes, we're seeing that big festivals will eventually come back, and that artists and creators, we have a, you know, audience of all types of creators. Basically, the space where that opportunity is for us to jump back into creating these moments, these experiences for people, is on the rise. And by the way, I should mention live streaming and the whole digital experience. I'm pretty sure, I wanted to ask your opinion about this, but I'm just going to throw in my opinion. I do believe now we've come into the point where it is here to stay, and it will become a hybrid model to me. That's what I've been doing for the last, you know, 12 months. I created my own space, actually did created a course for live streaming. I'd never done this before, kind of like you. I didn't know anything about webcams and the streaming and having to do the multicasting. And all of a sudden I have a brand for 12 months where I've been able to have one, like you mentioned, my local friends, musician, safely, one person in my home. And suddenly it's like, wait, I have 100, 200, 300, 400 subscribers that I didn't have before. My YouTube was dead. And all of a sudden now, because again, I've started to build something for myself as a musician, I never wanted to be the person that was in front. I didn't want to be the promoter. I didn't want to go. But all of a sudden, like you said, the skills that I've honed and learned. I used to do also live events in my own town. Same thing. I'm not ready. I'm the guy back here. I'm not the guy who has to make these negotiations. So I love the fact that you're telling creators all over the place to take matters into your own hands. And then I'm sure once they need that next step level, they would come to someone like you. And again, you're more open. You're sharing the information. I mean, you have a podcast where you've gone through, I mean, I looked at it, it was almost like a 101 on music business at the Entertainment Engine. So I believe, I love the fact you're opening the door to people. You're not saying that, oh, you know, you just got to wait your turn. You're basically telling them again, take action, don't sit back and wait for things to happen.
Yeah, I think that's the ethos that Rebecca and I have had, because even when we spoke about it and we thought, well, are we going to do this? Are we not going to do this? And, you know, really sort of glad we have, really, because I also felt that she's a creative in her own right, and it helps her music. And to give you an idea, I'll sort of give you the flavor of, we can help promote you now. So we then promote your show. And the reason we do that is, one, you're part of our community. Uh-huh. So that then we start saying to the community that, you know, we've just done a show with Alan. It's really good. This is what he's up to. He's trying to provide this, and this. A few weeks ago, Becky works with her creative partner, a chap called Alan Glass. And Alan's co-written and wrote songs for George Benson, Aretha Franklin, everybody. I mean, literally everybody. He's just phenomenal. And Rebecca's worked with him for many, many years. So this is how we felt the podcast works really well. And, you know, they just co-written a song for the British gangster movie, which is called Nemesis, which is just being released in the UK. And it's just, I think, being taken by Samuel Goldwyn in the United States. They've just done the end credit theme song for it. Oh, I should share that and send that information to you. But the reason I'm explaining this is then it's a whole cross promotion. So we cross promote it on the website. We help the film company. We help Alan and Becky get known as the writers of what they're doing and pushing that music out there. So we see that as an integral part of the podcast community, like we would do with you. So we don't, coming back to my point of we share.
Yeah.
I think it's important to share now, because I think at the end of the day, I can impart my knowledge. Whether somebody takes it or not is entirely up to them. It's just been my road. That's what we're saying. But I do think that the world is a smaller place, and the music industry or the entertainment space is a very, very small place. And I think you have to come out with your gun blazing. And I think you have to have a standpoint to say, this is what we're going to do and this is why we're going to do it. Otherwise, no one else is going to tell you. And I suppose just to touch on your point earlier about musicians where, you know, they should take charge. The reason I say that is history shows with musicians that the music business can be a very cruel place to be. So when musicians turn around and say, oh, where's my royalty check? Or I didn't know I could claim PRS for this. Or I didn't know when I go into a bar that I write my set list down and I can actually get paid for it. I know that's basic stuff, but lots of people don't know that. And one of the other chaps we had on our podcast, he's sort of set up a new sync platform. So he's helping independent musicians get paid for their neighboring rights around the world and how to collect their money. So we just see it as a big community. And I think musicians, I'm going to use this quite big word, Alan, and I think musicians now have to be responsible for their own career. They have to understand how this business works, because then no one's going to tell them. So right, you've been the best guitarist on the planet, the best drummer on the planet. That's fantastic. But how are you going to earn a living? How are you going to get your bread, milk, cheese, butter, you know, at the supermarket? And as much as your landlord or your mortgage people are going to be really supportive, there's going to be a point when they say, yeah, enough's enough.
The term sing for your supper will not work with the power company. It will not work with the supermarket. It will not.
If you and I go into the supermarket and say, we got $100 worth of food, can we give you $50? They go, put $50 back and you can take the $50.
Exactly. It's a very simple transaction. Very simple. But yes, I love the fact that you're saying this because I do feel, and again, I don't want to be the complainer, I love this example of you being now having done
some of the biggest festivals in the UK, having created this spaces and creating spaces and dealing with it. That was not your training. And you still said, you know what? Let's be consistent. Let's treat people with communication. These are the threads I've found when you start talking. It just makes so much sense. It makes business sense. It makes human sense. Learn what you can learn. Share. Be gracious and treat people the right way. And then, of course, look out for their best interests so that they can make money, including the artists, including the people that are bringing you on. And then the stages keep getting bigger, it sounds like. You know, you started from the little venue, and then it goes to a college, and then it goes to, you know, but each time your process didn't seem to change. And that's what I love about it. Like from football all the way on, the process was still the same. The genres and the things around you, the environment's changed. You know, now we're in pandemics and live streaming and COVID and protocols and stuff. But I mean, am I right in saying this? I hope this is wrapped. Again, I go broad, broad, and try to bring it back in.
Yeah.
Is that what has been kind of like the secret of your success, is making sure that you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater when the circumstances change around you? You got to stay with those principles that work in art and in business. Is that?
Yeah. I think that's a completely fair point, Alan, to be honest, because I think, and Rebecca's heard me say this many, many times, consistency. People come up with great ideas, but they're never consistent, or they can't see it through. Now, sometimes you can't see a project through because there are outside forces that are very difficult to manage, and that's completely understandable. But it doesn't mean to say that you can't, you know, pivot around that or look at a different way. Maybe you could, you know, you can make it, you know, something happen. And I think I don't want to use the term either of moaning. That's the wrong term. But I do think musicians have got a great opportunity. We had another conversation with a very good friend of ours. She's probably one of the best music promotion experts in the UK. She works with all the major labels. She's worked with some of the biggest acts on the planet. And she's lovely, and she's really to the point. And she's turned around to us and said, it's a great time for musicians to release music. You don't have to have a massive PR campaign. You don't have to, you're not telling us to put thousands of dollars behind stuff, because most people can't afford that. And everyone understands that, but doesn't mean to say you can't put stuff into the community. And I would say it's building like a podcast, put something into community, put a record out, put an album out, build it and keep doing it. You know, I don't mean doing one every day, but, you know, keep positively doing that. And I think that's a really good way to go, because the community sees you consistently. Over time, if a bigger label or a bigger promoter or a bigger publicist comes and wants to work with you, that's great. You look at that opportunity at that time. That's come along because you've been consistent with what you do. Right. And I think that's really, really, really important. Things go wrong, in my personal opinion, because too many people in a room, and there's always someone in that room that thinks they've got something bigger to say than anyone else. Never works. Never, 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 never works. The big sort of grounding point for me, being a promoter and some of the stuff that I've done, the real leveler, Alan, is when young promoters come up to me, when I've had conversations, we've had a cup of coffee, whatever it might be, and they've got great ideas and they want to put on a great event, my first two questions are, and they hate these questions, are, where is your business plan and how much money do you need? Oh, yeah, it's fine. We'll go and sell a load of tickets. It'd be great. Are you really going to go and sell a load of tickets? Well, are you thinking that we can't? No. What I'm saying to you is, don't rely on your ticket sales to pay for your event. Because if your event costs $10,000 and you need to sell 5,000 tickets, for example, and you only sell 2,000, where's your shortfall? So start thinking about your ancillary income, start thinking about your merchandise, start thinking about your catering rights, start thinking about, is there going to be TV rights? Are you going to get sponsors in? Da, 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 da. And they don't like it. And I've had a couple of promoters come to me and say, oh, we'll just walk into the bank and the bank would give us like $200,000-$300,000. I'm like, good luck with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'll tell you the conversation the bank's going to say to you, you'll sit down and have a nice cup of coffee with your bank manager. He or she will turn around and say, this is really great. Love what you're doing. Let me look at your business plan. If you haven't got that, that's a red flag in the corner. Second thing is, if they you get over your business plan and they like what you're doing and they feel there's a connection there, you're going to talk about money, they're going to ask you, have you got any security to put up? And you're going to go, well, I don't know. Are you going to go back and have that conversation with your mum and dad to say, you're going to put your house up for security with the bank if it all goes wrong? And people look at me as if I've just, if I've fallen off a tree or something, or where have I come from? And then it's the process, Alan. They have to go through the process. So when they come back to you and say, yeah, I didn't get the money, or I couldn't go and raise $250,000 or $1 million, well, it's difficult. So I think people just got to embrace that information, and whether they start off as a little acorn and they want to go into something that's going to be a Coachella, fantastic. But there are means and ways of doing that. And I think sometimes people are not prepared for that. For that, really.
Yeah, but the reality of it. But again, I think there's the reality, and then there's the opportunity. The reality is there, but the reality presents an opportunity that, again, whether you're someone that's starting local, whether you've been in the industry for 10, 20 years, I've heard this again from some of the people that you and I both, we talked about this, the circle. We both interviewed people where they have achieved high success. And now they're like, yeah, but I'm ready for something different. And they go have to go back to square one and continue to be a learner, continue to be humble, continue to say, hey, you know, like I mentioned Daniel Weatherspoon, he mentioned that being on that stage in Wembley with Beyonce and then turning around and releasing his own album as a smooth jazz artist and nobody coming to the concert because they all knew him as an MD. And yes. Not another world. And he said the exact same things you're saying about having to learn those little details of who's going to back up the venue. Am I going to be able to bring on my musicians? He had to be that singular promoter. And again, I'm talking not just about him, but you know, all across the board, you and I both know people who've had to be rudely reminded of the realities of business. But again, it doesn't stop them. It just means take a step back. That's what I'm hearing. Take a step back, be humble, be consistent, learn the trade, just like any other musician or, you know, football or anything, learn the trade, learn the skills, and then apply them over time. So I love this. We could be talking forever. I'm looking at time. I don't even know how long this podcast is going to be anymore. But I'd love to get number one, two things from you as you close out. Excuse me. One thing that I would love for you to share is, you know, what is the best advice you would give? And I think you already gave it, but just to kind of like put a pin on it. Your best advice to give for anyone who was where you were. In other words, maybe they're, I don't know if they're an athlete, but there's someone who is right at that moment where you were at 16, 17, 18 years old. So what do you wish the advice, you know, what advice did you get or did you wish someone had told you at that moment when they were kind of in that place of, oh my gosh, I thought this was going to be this my life and now it's going to be something totally different. So what advice would you give to someone who is where you were at that point where you started to make the path into, you know, what eventually became your life's advice and your life's success?
I think be open to learning, ask lots and lots of questions and be consistent. Just be consistent. If you really want to do something, be consistent, ask lots of questions and basic things as well. Be polite. Turn up on time and smile. I know it's basic, but I'll tell you what, when I learn how to make tea and coffee for different people at labels, and if they're having a bad day and I come with a cup of coffee and a nice bit of cake, I know it's funny, but you'll certainly see a smile out of someone, a senior person or a director. They will sit down with you for 5 minutes and say, what are you up to? So I think they're the things that I've learned. It's taken me through, you know, through sport. Consistency is the biggest one, because if you're consistent, you're polite, and you're open to learning, I don't think there's much more you can do, because you can be a sponge. And then I think people will notice you. And I think that's how you can get on. And also, I suppose one of the other things I would say is the internet is a massive resource now. It's a massive resource. So anyone that's, I didn't have that in my time when I was 14, 15, 16, the internet was only just maybe just being flickered about.
Yeah.
So now I think the younger people have got maybe more of an opportunity to actually do even more research. And I think that's a good thing because absolutely, everything's accessible.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah. The world has opened up in terms of information. The world is opening up in terms of the opportunities. And Peter, I just want to thank you again. There's a far ranging conversation. Again, it was so amazing that again, meeting us, for the first time. I feel like again, that it did break down that barrier. Thank God. I know promoters and people in the industry who have always had that same spirit you just mentioned, who have been learned. They've been teachable, who want to learn, who have the exact same spirit of wanting to see other people succeed. And that's the spirit that came across with you. I love this interview, this conversation, and I hope you'll come back. I hope you'll be back, hopefully to teach and share. We have so many other programs that I want to do, and I want to continue to learn from you. Let them know, again, there's some old school people that still write things down. So for those who want to find your company, Seamless Entertainment, who want to find your podcast, let them know where to find you. And so they can continue the conversation with you as well.
Yeah, it's very open, very easy to find. So if you want to check us out, they can go to seamlessentertainment.co.uk and also just put in the Entertainment Engine. We're on pretty much every podcast platform. Our social media is all on our website. Everything's all accessible from there. Come by and say hello. Happy to have a chat.
I'm looking forward to listening to more of the Entertainment Engine. I can't recommend it enough to everybody that's listening. You guys are all podcast listeners who are listening or watching right now. So everything that we try to discuss in God and Gigs in a general sense, Peter and your, my IDD just kicked in, your partner, your co-host.
Rebecca Gregory. Yeah.
You guys both cover the gamut. So everything you've mentioned in, you know, about things to learn about the industry, you guys cover, even in just the first couple of episodes about licensing. I want to go back and study right now. So please go check out that podcast. I highly, highly recommend that. Peter, thank you for coming across the seas and talking to me. And I look forward to another conversation very soon. All God's best to you.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show. And I probably think, your weather's a bit better than ours at the moment.
It's nice and balmy, 70 something right now. So yeah,
that's cool.
I'll try to send some of that sunshine. We'll send it on. That'll be in the gift box. It'll be in the gift box.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure. I hope you understand now why Peter was the perfect person to have to talk about the industry, about positioning, about festivals, and why you don't have to be afraid of what's coming next in a post-COVID music and entertainment industry. He really just set us up to understand that we have the power. And just like big corporations and big labels are trying to figure out what to do next, and big festivals are trying to figure out what they're going to do next, you can also take the same mentality of thinking through your next business, your next musical, your next artistic decision in terms of what do I have control over? What can I prepare for? How can I prepare in advance? And how can I be in the best possible shape to move my career forward no matter what happens on the outside? I love his take on it, his no nonsense, and his direct encouragement to each of us to do just that. So I hope you took that and anything else that you took away from this episode, and you're going to apply it to your creative life, because it definitely hit home for me. And I realized there's some things I can go and do right now. I've got some homework after this episode, and I hope that you will take it as a challenge as well to step forward and prepare for the best new normal you can possibly have when it comes to your creative career, music, art, presentation, speaking, whatever you do. I believe that this is going to help you do that. Okay. So if it is going to help you, please leave a review and tell me that you liked this show. Share this show, this episode with somebody else in your world that has the same kind of questions as you, because Peter answered a plethora of questions that even I had, and I believe he's going to help some of your friends as well. Now, that's it for this particular show and this episode, but I hope you have subscribed so you won't miss the next episode. We'll continue to share the things that will help you be a better creative, that will help you center yourself, ground yourself, and really be a creative with impact, okay? So until next time, continue to become the creative that you were created to be. Be safe out there, keep pushing forward, and I'll see you in our next episode. Take care for now.
Thanks for joining us here at the God and Gigs Show. Please leave us a review on iTunes, like our Facebook page, or visit godandgigs.com and tell us what you thought of this show. We'll be back soon. In the meantime, go create something amazing.